I'm gonna have some of my Dorito chips, all right, Craig?
You know, Edwin, you know your headset, if you flip that up, if you flip it up all the way, it mutes it, so we don't have to hear you crunching on chips.
I'm still gonna eat my chips.
Well, no, just flip it up. Flip, you see what I'm saying?
You know
flip
what? Okay, fine. I won't even eat my
No,
chips.
No, I'm saying, Edwin, you're not listening to me. Edwin, you can mute your mic. I have those same headphones. I'm not using it for recording, but see what I'm doing? You muted yourself. We can't hear you. So now, when like that, you can eat your chips. And then when you want to talk to us, you put it back down. But yeah, that's, I knew there was a way to do it. Just get, because I do shit all the time. I'm like honking horns and stuff in here.
I've got hot wiring cars.
Yeah,
hacking
I've got,
into the mainframe.
I'm playing the handbells like at a Christmas pageant.
Hello, Secret Movie Clubbers. Welcome to Secret Movie Club Podcast 22. Today, we are going to be talking about our first weekend of parking lot cinema, which it's in the books. We did it. The team did it. We got through it. The theme today is going to be John Hughes teen movies of the 80s. Before I get into anything else, who is with us today? Who's on the call or who's on the podcast?
Hello, it's Daniel.
It's me, Connor, the criminal.
It's me, Edwin. Too damn tired for this.
There you go. That's almost a Danny Glover. Kind of like a weak Danny Glover. This is Craig, founder, programmer, Secret Movie Club. Many of us, including some who haven't been on the podcast but are behind the scenes, like Casey Young, Stephen Brownlee, Edwin Gomez, Daniel Ott, Edwin got Angelica. We'll see if she ever comes again after she got 2.5 hours of bathroom duty. God bless Angelica. So, Secret Movie Clubbers, we want to thank you. With our partners, Electric Dust Drive-In, you all met us in Glendale at the Sears parking lot. We got between 110 to 125 cars into that lot both nights. Guess what? Getting that many cars and then doing a double feature where you have to swap out 50 cars and get in 50 new cars at 10:30, I didn't really think that one through. I guess because we've been doing all our movies in movie theaters. But Electric Dust Drive-In, they were incredible. They've been doing this kind of thing, pop-up outdoor cinema, for a long time. There were two committed parking attendants. The first night, I tried to help them. They did not want my help. The second night, I was like, I'm just going to let you guys be you. And it went great. One of them, I'll just tell this story really quickly. A guy named Michael, who literally dresses like the dude, he was in a blue bathrobe, a cigarette, and a shirt that said, "You hurt my eyes too," which I was like, I wonder for customer service. But damn, was he a good parker. He came up to me and he was like, night one, he's like, "Craig, we got a Karen over there. You want to deal with her?" And I had just caught up with the lingo. And I was like, "Michael, I don't know if we want to be calling the audience members Karens." He's like, "Well, what am I going to do? That's what she is. She's a Karen. Go deal with her." So I guess
it's better than the word we would have used to use.
That's true. So then it turned out there was someone, I guess, who was the parking lot attendants were not getting well. I'm not going to go into any more detail just in case. But anyway, at the end of the night,
it was Roseanne Barr.
I sort of debriefed with the parking lot attendants because I could tell they were stressed and I wasn't helping them. And I was like, guys, you know, how did it go? And Michael was smoking a cigarette. He's like, "Listen, man, you just got to accept some people suck." He's like, "You seem like a guy who wants to look at the best in people. Look, your life's going to be a lot better if you just accept some people suck. Hey, bro, there are rattlesnakes in the world. I wish there weren't, but there are. The sooner you accept the rattlesnakes, you'll have a better life." And I was like, "Michael, you're dropping some wisdom on my dome." And then he was like, "Yeah, I'm moving to Florida and I'm getting a boat and I'm getting into real estate." And then that was a whole other thing. But anyway, we got through it. Friday night, we showed Ferris Bueller's Day Off in the Breakfast Club. Saturday night, which went much smoother, we showed National Lampoon's Vacation and Weird Science. So that's that. In terms of announcements, real quickly, I got to stop saying real quickly. I don't know if it's going to be quick or not. Announcements at the head of the show. We lived through the first weekend. Everybody, we only had two people who left for actually very legitimate reasons. So out of, I think, 300 cars, 298 of them stayed. So we are doing our second weekend. We're going to keep at this again at the Sears Glendale lot if you live in Southern California. On Friday, we are going to do a Greater Los Angeles Comedies double feature. The A movie at 8:15 will be The Big Lebowski. The B movie will be Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love. Saturday night, we're calling it High School Double Album. So we're doing Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused at 8:15. And then at 10:30 p.m., we are doing Amy Heckerling's Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I always love showing those movies. And I went to high school in Southern California. So the Sean Penn character, who's a stoner surfer, 40% of my class, no, that's high, maybe 20 to 25% of my class was Jeff Spicoli. So anyway, we would love to have you. You can get tickets at Eventbrite. Just go Secret Movie Club, eventbrite.com, or you can go Electric Dust Drive-In, our partners, Eventbrite. And as always, if you want to write us, community@secretmovieclub.com or podcast@secretmovieclub.com, we are about to record our third Secret Movie Club Radio Hour, written and directed by Mr. Daniel Ott. And this one will be coming out in September. We'll let you know when. And then after that, we're doing a Halloween episode, and then we're going to do a season finale. So thank you guys also for downloading those. We're now in August 2020, and we've been doing these podcasts since about a week after COVID hit. And even though it's very slow, very glacial, with stops and starts, we are showing movies again. We are back to screening. So, you know, that is a milestone. So thank you, Secret Movie Clubbers, for actually selling out our first two back to, even though they were drive-ins, different than in the movie theaters. So thank you. And we're going to just keep building whatever it is we're building. And we're building it with you because it's a community thing of movie love. So thank you. The John Hughes teen movie is a very specific thing. Just to give background, so John Hughes was actually in marketing. No surprise, actually, because as I did my research on him, marketing was always in the back of his head. And we're not going to get into this probably this podcast, but I think his third phase, where he was just doing kids' movies after Home Alone, might be, you could see that marketing instinct maybe at its worst, I might argue. But he was in marketing writing copy, and he sent the National Lampoons in the 70s, because he was a boomer, like all the SNL guys. He's really of that generation. He was born in the 50s. He sent them a short story called Vacation 58, which was about a family having a horrible road trip to Disneyland, and then the dad shoots Walt Disney in the leg with a BB gun. Of course, you'll recognize that as being changed into National Lampoon's Vacation later on. But John Hughes became one of the biggest writers at National Lampoon's. He became an editor at National Lampoon's. A lot of people forget that he actually wrote the forgotten National Lampoon's movies between Animal House and Vacation. There's one called Class Reunion. I can't even remember what the other one is called.
I have that movie.
And John Hughes was, those were the forgotten ones. So when they came time to do Vacation, National Lampoon's needed a hit. John Hughes needed a hit. Chevy Chase needed a hit. And they got a hit with Harold Ramis. And we'll get into it. I guess we'll probably kick it off since chronologically that's the first one. But John Hughes actually had such a, he just wrote it. He would go on to direct at a blistering pace a series of teen comedies with heart that became a genre unto themselves. And he would eventually graduate out of that into adult movies with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, She's Having a Baby, The Great Outdoors, and Uncle Buck, which was his middle period. And then when Home Alone came around, he basically just made kids' movies. And then he died very early. He died at 59 in 2009. So we really were robbed of what might have been a fourth phase, or who knows what he would have done. Kind of like George Miller came back and did Fury Road. But Vacation was the first, and he was just a writer on it, not a producer, just a writer. And the producers and director, Harold Ramis, who was kind of hot off of Caddyshack and Stripes, they decided that the original John Hughes script had Russ, the son, it was told from his point of view. It totally would have been a John Hughes movie. And when they see the model in the sports car, that was Russ in the back seat looking at the model. So it was a total coming of age, John Hughes POV movie about this guy learning about it, that his dad is just human, getting along with his sister and kind of having his sexual awakening. Well, when Chevy Chase came on board, they were like, well, no, this is now going to be a Chevy Chase vehicle. And it is a hilarious movie and it works well with Chase, but they switched it. So now it's contemporary. It's not Disneyland. It's not the 50s. It's Wally World, because Disneyland wouldn't give them permission. And then the guy having the fantasies is the dad. He's the one who flirts with the supermodel on the road, which introduces a weird thing of like, you're supposed to like him as a dad, as a husband. But at the same time, he's like openly in front of his wife the whole movie. Like literally that picnic scene plays really weird to me now, sort of being disrespectful to her. But it was a different time.
I had seen the first two film, the double feature. The first double feature, Ferris Bueller and Breakfast Club, quite a few times, but I hadn't seen either of the other two films until this weekend, but I watched them both. And Vacation definitely falls into I think I kind of have kind of defined it a little better. It's like early SNL films almost to a certain degree. It's like that kind of like that class, like 1941, like I was talking about, where I'm not a huge fan of them. That being said, I did like Vacation. I mean, Vacation's a thousand times better than 1941. it's
like, go there, Connor.
Hey,
go there, man.
Hey, I'm talking.
I was yelling.
Yeah, it's good. It's just it's like you're saying. It's like hard to. It's like a specific. Yeah, I don't know how much I like Chevy Chase. I love him in Community, but part of the reason he works in Community is because he's kind of genuinely the villain of the show a lot, especially in the second season. He's just like constantly a horrible person, and that's like what the show becomes about. But in this, you're still supposed to like him, and like the dog thing is like genuinely troubling for me as someone who loves dogs, and I get why it's funny. And it is kind of funny.
I have a soft spot for Vacation. I do think having now the knowledge of what it should have been does really makes you think, like you're talking about with the model subplot. It makes way more sense for an adolescent teen who's like struggling with
totally
with their, you know, who they're becoming through puberty than in like a dad. Because I think watching it now, it's like sort of a little creepy and absolutely insane for like his family being there. Vacation is quintessential dad movie, and I mean that in the most loving way. My dad loves Chevy Chase. Christmas Vacation, which I think is a lot better, is my dad's maybe his favorite film. And my dad is not a movie guy, but every Christmas when I arrive home, we like make a plan to watch Christmas Vacation. And I think that works. I mean, it still has like the, you know, some attractive woman that he is lustful toward in that capacity.
But... And also written, Christmas Vacation, also written by John Hughes, probably with a little more.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with a little more clout.
And I wonder if he knew, now that he knew that it was a Chevy Chase, he wasn't fighting against what he wanted it to be. Maybe he had a little more.
He wrote that one. And I think the second one, he has a story by credit, but he didn't actually write the screenplay.
For the European
Vacation.
Yeah. He's involved in the first three, but not the Vegas one.
Christmas really focuses on family, but I think some of it's great. Like, I love John Candy's cameo, and it has really great moments, and I think it's 90 minutes, so it doesn't feel long.
Yeah.
It feels very brief.
I'll just say this. I liked it. I think I would like it more. Something you guys, I think, are I don't know if you guys are exactly talking about this. I would have liked it more if it had committed either way, if it had, like, been the John Hughes thing, or if it had just gone full dark. And it just been like when Chevy Chase is like saying the F word at his family repeatedly.
Yeah.
Is probably the funniest moment in the movie to me, or one of the funniest, because it goes that far. And I wish the movie had gone one of those ways, if that makes sense. Yeah,
the setup, my favorite setup to a joke is on the roller coaster when John Candy's like, has your dad killed anyone? And he goes, it's like, oh, only one person this week. Because, you know, we've lost the dog and the aunt. And I think that lineup, in terms of that type of humor, it is sort of jarring. And I mean, he's like, I think what Chevy Chase does successfully is he, as a character, should be impossible to like. He is like a scummy dude and like kills a dog and like lets his aunt die and then like leaves her on a porch where they talk about putting her on the roof. And somehow he's like charismatic enough to carry it. Yeah, it's a weird one. I don't think you can make it. I think didn't they try to remake it a few years ago with like Ed Helms?
And it's funny, it wasn't a remake. It was Ed Helms' Rust.
The sequel.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It got better reviews than Vegas Vacation or the National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's Island Vacation. Adventure. It doesn't use Vacation twice in the title. That would be nuts.
I like Vacation. I think it's one of my favorite Chevy Chase movies. It's just, I told you this before. The one part of the movie I did not like, the chick in the Ferrari. I would accept it the other way around with if it was being Russ that was, you know.
Flirting with Christy Brinkley.
Yeah.
Well, I think Edwin and I talked at the screening. Like, it just doesn't do that subplot. Doesn't move anything forward.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It's just like, it's sort of like this joke that's not, that exists and then keeps coming back but does nothing for character development. It's very odd.
You know, watching it again, and I've seen it a few times, I think it holds up. I think it's funny. I think there are enough jokes. It does that thing you need where you remember scenes and sequences. You sort of look forward to them coming up. I think for a comedy to be rewatchable, you've got to be like, oh, that sequence is coming up.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that. And I mean, maybe it's just my sensibility. I love animals. I've tried never to harm any animal in my life. I still find that dog leash thing hilarious. The way that it's set up and then the cop loses it. I also love the third act. I think it's great that it's closed and that he just loses his shit and like forces them to. I think that's great. And I think the family's really well cast. I think the thing for me, and Connor, you were hinting at it, I do like Chevy Chase, but he does a very specific thing. And I think as an adult, I realize that Chevy Chase does Chevy Chase. So there's that scene where they're in Monument Valley, and I think it's meant to be written where he and Russ have a bonding moment over a beer before he runs off to the gas station. And it does kind of play that way. The John Hughes writing kind of does still succeed. But Chevy Chase is sort of making fun of it. He's mocking it. He's not really playing a dad connecting with his kid. Whereas I think if John Hughes had directed it and had it not been Chevy Chase, I think that would have been one of the moments that would have been the hearts of the movie. And then maybe the way it would have been directed when the thing goes south with the, first off, it would have been Russ. But I think even if it had been John Hughes, there would have been some moment where the wife would have, would have taken him to task. They would have talked and he would have been like, that was a big mistake. I have this family and I put everything at risk when I already have. That would have been the John Hughes beat. And I think instead what you get, and I'm not saying it's wrong, it's just a different way of going, is I think it was a lot of it was purely for jokes. So when I see Vacation now, I really love it. I'll watch Vacation again anytime. I'll probably show it to my kids. But it is more kind of a joke machine movie. That's not really even doing it justice. It's just not a John Hughes movie. I guess that's all. Chronologically, what happened after that with John Hughes was he was like never again. And he directed 16 Candles, which we're not going to talk about now, but that was his debut, wrote and directed it. Monster hit. And this began a ridiculous rate of John Hughes movies. Hughes, like John Sayles and very few other writers that I know, was capable of writing a script in 2 to 3 days. I was reading that Breakfast Club was written in 2 to 3 days. Ferris Bueller's was written in 2 to 3 days. Weird Science was written in 2 to 3 days. And some of the other ones maybe took a week, maybe took 2 weeks. He hated rewriting. So he would just go through it, kind of do a polish, and then figure the rest out on the set with the actors. Although it was very written, and you can tell. John Hughes movies do not feel like improv movies at all. They feel like John Hughes movies, very written movies. So literally, maybe less than a year after 16 Candles, Breakfast Club came out. And John Hughes had wanted Breakfast Club to be his debut, but for whatever reason, 16 Candles went first. Breakfast Club, everybody knows, but if you don't know, it's this movie about 5 high school archetypes, the jock, the rebel, the nerd, the misfit, and the princess. They all get Saturday detention with the principal who has a power complex. And then here we see John Hughes in full bloom. Some might argue maybe too much bloom, where there's comedy and then full out heart on your sleeve emotion. And we see the whole Saturday and the teenagers reveal things about themselves and relationships and bonds are formed and emotions are shared. So, and it was a monster hit. If 16 Candles was a monster hit, Breakfast Club, I think, was even more of a monster hit. And often people usually debate between Breakfast Club and Ferris as their favorite John Hughes.
Maybe I'm biased because I saw them when I was younger, but if the plan was to this weekend to bill an A movie, a better movie with a lesser movie, I think you goofed up big time because I think you stacked that first night because I think Ferris Bueller and Breakfast Club were much stronger. I think are both genuinely like affected me, you know, not just right. Being like, oh, this is fun to watch. We'll get to Ferris because I think it might have affected me more, but yeah, I mean, this movie's great.
Yeah, I'll take it from here. You know, I grew up watching Breakfast Club, you know, as during my teen years, you know, I always brought the soundtrack with me whenever I go to school, just play it. Seeing teenagers back then and looking at back today, like, damn, that's really weird. They all that stuff. That's f-ing weird. I think my favorite character would have to be Judd Nelson. Because he's like, I know he's the rebel and slash, you know, kind of funny guy.
You could also call him the kid from the wrong side of the tracks, the poor kid.
Yeah.
He also plays that role in the movie, which John Hughes would often do. There'd be class issues in John Hughes movies, especially the later two
movies. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Who identified with which character the most? I'm big surprise. You know what I'm going to guess? All 4 of us identify as Anthony Michael Hall.
Yes.
Whoa.
Okay.
That's a no-brainer.
The volume in this room is
though,
very loud.
I would say there's little shades of some Ali Sheedy stuff in terms of perception when I was younger, but yeah.
You related with Judd Nelson, so I mean, there's 3 of us.
Yeah, I do too, because every time I leave school, I always do the iconic scene where Judd Nelson is on the football field. He does the that I always did that.
But do you actually relate to him, like, as a character?
Yeah, I was a terrible student in high school. I always got into trouble, like, nonstop. There's even times that I pulled off a Ferris Bueller, which I just stayed home for most of the time, watched movies.
That is not a surprise to me.
Yeah, I know. But it was fun, though. I had a great time.
Any other thoughts about Breakfast?
You know, it's just one of the best 80s teen movies of all time. Like even today, people are still, teenagers today, they are still talking about that movie. I have friends that still love that movie. Especially that whole monologue scene where they're all revealing their feeling. That was good writing. Especially how the camera works. You know, shooting, and then bam. Like, damn, that son of a bitch knows how to write and shoot. That's a great scene. It made me tear up.
There you go. You've already blown through your swearing now, Edwin. No more F's.
Well, no, guess what? You can't censor me, man.
We literally
we
do.
We can, and we do.
Constantly.
That's what we're asking. I would prefer not. You still misunderstand this request.
I literally have a tally of how much.
I prefer not to censor you, which is why I ask you not to swear.
I feel like this, kind of the same thing. I saw it as a teen, and I feel like I've had the craziest, like a slinky with this movie, where sometimes I don't like it, sometimes I love it, and the older I feel like every time you rewatch it at a different stage in your life, it is something completely different to you.
Great call.
I think because of that, because as a teen you see it and you might see things that you relate to, and then you get to, like, you know, college or your 20s, and you don't want to relate to that because it seems like melodramatic, or, like, you know, you don't want to be bunched into, like, this cliche. Then you get a little older and you look back and you're like, okay, I was a little bit, you know. I think it captures teen angst in a way that also focuses on sort of the intimacy and the emotion of it that a lot of teen movies, especially this era, won't do. The idea, like, these people having breakdowns and talking about their life and, like, talking to each other about things that aren't just surface level jokes. They have to actually, like, connect as humans.
And causality.
Yeah, that connection, I think, is why it's special.
This movie made me, like, reevaluate some trauma I have from when I was a kid rewatching it. Which I'm not going to get into, because...
There's an earnestness to it. There's that John Hughes earnestness that I think as a teen I didn't want to relate to, because you're like, I don't want, you know, I wouldn't do that with my friends. And then you sort of realize later that you need that. It's important to have that with people that are close to you. And these people become close over a day. And I think having this single set and these shared circumstances that connect them and to slowly let it come out. I think Breakfast Club does a fairly good job of balancing the idea that no one is one thing. They are not defined by this one thing, especially in high school where you are so often in movies, especially are guilty of that, really define you by this singular thing that you are as you try to figure out, you know, the multitudes of your existence. My weirdest thing on this rewatch is that Judd Nelson just gives so much to this performance that sometimes I found it a little distracting. Like, he has given it his all to a point. I can't get over the line. I wrote it down, but I blotted my note. But it was something about, like forget you dildos or something. Well, I won't say it. I'll keep my swear meter down. But he, like, calls everyone a name and walks away. And then the next time we see him, he's talking to them about weed. And it's the most jarring. Like, you're like, wait a second. What? How did we go from this to this? Just in performance and... I
kind of like that, how the movie kind of will just, like, skip over. Mm-hmm. There's, like, obviously beats, character beats kind of happening off screen that the movie just kind of lets you assume. Yeah, my only real issue is because the climax of the movie is, this is, like, from a narrative point of view, because I think the movie is, like, pretty great. At the end, because the climax is the scene where they're all talking, that very long scene where they're all sitting in a circle, and then the sort of the action scene equivalent of the climax is the dance.
Right.
And then after that, I wish the only beats I like after that is, I like the essay, I like the earring, and I like the fist pump, but the romantic pairings I don't really like and don't buy, and I also don't like the makeover. I think it kind of completely undercuts, like, the message of the film.
Right.
And is very strange.
For me, I've always admired Breakfast Club more than actually really genuinely liked it. And that's not true. I mean, I like it, but I definitely am a Ferris Bueller's person, or a 16 Candles, or a Weird Science even, over Breakfast Club. For me, I love intense drama, but sometimes if I feel something's too serious or self-serious, it's just not my wavelength if I feel it's a little too much or a little overheated. And when I watch Breakfast Club, I mean, I wrote a high school script that I wanted to be my debut feature, and I filled it with, like, intense scenes and stuff as well as comedy. So, I mean, I totally respect and admire and even probably tried to shoot for the Breakfast Club tone. I just find that some of the scenes where the characters are crying or, like, screaming or yelling, or it gets real dramatic, it feels like the performances are a little too much for me, or a little too, I would have probably balanced it out a little bit more or undercut that with a little humor. Or if there was that moment, I would have had a joke, just because I always find that kind of balance and contrast makes everything work better. That's me. That's my own aesthetic. I love that D.D. Allen edited this. I'm a huge D.D. Allen fan, and they always brought D.D. Allen on when they needed a movie that was real talky to be cinematic. D.D. Allen edited Dog Day Afternoon, Bonnie and Clyde, Slaughterhouse-Five. One of her late great achievements was editing James Brooks' As Good As It Gets, which supposedly had something like 200 hours of footage, and D.D. Allen would just figure it out. Breakfast Club is actually, oddly, of the teen movies I've seen, and I have not seen Pretty in Pink or Some Kind of Wonderful, I'll just say that right now, I love when it's John Hughes with a lot of humor. I don't know that I'm as big into John Hughes' really intense drama. That's me.
I normally agree with you. I just think this one balances it well for me.
Most people do. I think I'm in the minority on that.
Feels truthful in a way.
John Hughes movies, like all movies, the culture moves on, and then people look back at them and they're like, oh, that doesn't work now for us 30, 40 years later. Molly Ringwald wrote a piece fairly recent where she just talked about how looking back at movies like 16 Candles and Breakfast Club that have scenes that now really, you know, charitably, you could say involve non-consensual sexual contact, you know, or you could, if you want, didn't want to be charitable, you could say now could be looked at as assault or date rape. The way that it's treated in a comedic and a light way, it's problematic for sure. And so Breakfast Club has a scene where the rebel basically hides underneath Molly Ringwald's skirt and does something that's played for comedy that at the time everybody felt was comedy, and then they end up together. But looking back at it 40 years, you'd be like, well, they weren't even getting along at that point. Like, in that point in the movie, they weren't even flirting or crushing with each other. They still didn't like it. Well, although you could argue maybe they did like each other because they end up as a couple. You know, they are a product of their time. And for a movie maker and a movie programmer, I've just made the decision that, yes, we're going to address it, of course. Yes, we are going to be cognizant and we are going to contextualize. So I want to be real clear. It's not like we're just going to throw something on and be ignorant that the culture has moved on. I think that is ignorant.
There's also a worth to it. And even Molly Ringwald's piece talks about how, despite all these things, there have been a lot of people who have come up to her in the years talking about how it allowed them to accept themselves.
Totally. And in the end, I go by where is the heart of this movie? And if there are things that haven't aged well, I accept them, and I just accept them as a product of their time. But if I feel that the heart is still in a universal place, which I think it is in John Hughes movies, then, you know, I move past it. And judging by our audiences, I'm not trying to force a conclusion, but both nights were sold out for every single film. And we didn't have any protests or people coming up and being like, how dare you show these movies? Not always, but often the debate will be, what's your favorite John Hughes movie? In fact, someone created a Twitter poll. I don't know if you guys saw that. They linked us into it. They were like, okay, what's better, Ferris Bueller's Breakfast Club? I think that's a bit of a false dichotomy. I do think they're different movies for sure. I almost think Ferris Bueller's Day Off is what you would call sui generis, which means it is of its own thing. I think even among John Hughes canon, Ferris Bueller sort of stands in its own place, but that's me. But John Hughes did Breakfast Club. Then actually, let's do this. Let's end with Ferris, because after Breakfast Club, he did Weird Science. 6 months after Breakfast Club, he had already written and directed another film. And that film was Weird Science.
Weird Science is a movie that I saw for the first time this week and is about two boys who use a computer and narrative convenience to create a beautiful woman who then helps them become men, essentially. I don't actually have much to say about it. It's very bizarre. Seeing it for the first time, I was like, what is this movie? Like, I had always had the conception that it was going to be more about them making her, but that just kind of happens. And then all this other stuff sort of happens. And Craig, you want to talk about Mary Poppins? You talk about Mary Poppins.
It just, you become aware slowly that he's taken Disney's Mary Poppins and he's turned it into a teen sex comedy. That's all I
want to say. That makes sense. That's an interesting way to look at it. It was fun. I feel like compared to Vacation, it's decidedly less serious than these other films, I feel, at least.
People often point out that Weird Science is John Hughes at his craziest. John Hughes never made another movie like Weird Science. Like, that almost feels like he needed to have fun and still be productive. That movie feels like everything in the kitchen sink.
That was my first time seeing it.
What do you think?
When you were talking about the premise of this movie and I sort of looked up the general synopsis, I was like, wow, this is going to, I'm like already preparing for like how this conversation, but it's weirdly, it is absolutely bizarre. I don't think something like that would be made again. It's bizarre in the John Hughes world of things because it doesn't, the core of it fits. And the performances and like general plotting of it, I guess. But it's interesting because it definitely has its issues and just general premise. But at the end of the day, Kelly LeBrock sort of is the hero of the story, and she also finds, I mean, she's, you know, she's this created perfect thing that these adolescent boys make. But at the end of it, she is, as you said, the Mary Poppins. She is this teacher, and then gets to become what she wants to become. I mean, what John Hughes wants her to become in the realm of writing. But in the movie, is sort of empowered by that.
A really hot gene teacher.
And there's shots like the last shot of her that you're like, nope, don't do that. it is bizarre, but it's zany enough that I had a very good time. There's some great beats. Some of it, if you were to explain this or see clips of this, like Matt, the guy from, you know, someone from The Road Warrior and The Hills Have Eyes show up in the middle of a party to like wreck havoc on a house party that's happening.
Bill Paxton turns into a like a Muppet feces monster.
His performance is incredible. And he is so funny.
A rocket ship appears and like destroys half the house.
The zany is the word. Even Ferris has a very heartfelt emotional moment with the Cameron and his dad. But Weird Science, it definitely has heart, but the movie is zany. It's just zany from start to finish. It's like John Hughes wanted to give people a bonbon or something, but a mid-80s crazy Reagan 80s America where like what is going on in the mind of this culture bonbon. So kind of like a bonbon laced with mescaline or something.
My only wrap up to say is I think the important thing, the way I have to look at this movie, at its core, this runs the risk of being sort of a toxic thing in the eyes of a prepubescent boy watching it. But Kelly LeBrock has to carry the whole movie, which she does. And I'm sort of surprised. I looked at her career after this and she didn't really do much, which surprised me because she's great in this.
I agree. Yeah, it is a real kind of mystery because she's hilarious.
But the boy, I mean, the guys do nothing. They make like no decisions. Their entire like premise is like they like, you know, have a stare off with their bullies and sort of have some girlfriends.
They do pull a gun on the apocalyptic dudes.
True. But like besides that, everything else relies on Kelly LeBrock to carry it. And I think that's kind of insane. And like her personality is what makes the movie work on top of it all.
This was a pretty fun movie. This was like John Hughes at his craziest before he lowered down to his regular day. But this movie was like all over the place, especially with the Mad Max people coming in. The whole weird making of the woman, like all like the weird zany thing that's happening. It was such a great, great, great comedy. I loved it. I think I'll watch it again later tonight just to get a third opinion, but there's a good chance I'm gonna love it again. It's just a fun 80s teen comedy, man. It's like, it's fun as hell.
I have to say that I think possibly Weird Science and Ferris Bueller's Day Off are the two greatest teen movies John Hughes ever made. And although I was partial to Weird Science, because again, my sister and I, all these stories begin with after the divorce. That's like literally going to be the first phrase of every movie story I tell. My dad got us a Weird Science. And back in the day, you'd rent a VHS and you'd return it like, you know, 2 days later or whatever. So we would go to the video store because we were with my dad on weekends. And my dad would sometimes let us watch it for two or three times in a row if he had to work, you know, because he was just getting into public school teaching. So Heather and I like loved Weird Science so much at 8 and 6 years old. We watched it three times one weekend and we just went around quoting it. And my mother was really unsettled because my sister would like, or I would go around and be like, oh, you know, everything's going to be the chains, whip, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And my mother would be like, what are you quoting? And my sister would be like, don't worry, nothing too kinky, just wax on the nipples. And my mother would be like, what is that? And then she'd have to call my dad and be like, what did you let them watch? When we showed it this weekend, I thought it was one of the most inventive, creative. I totally was nervous. I want to be very clear. And, you know, who knows if we hadn't had that audience, if we'd been an indoor Vista audience that maybe is a little more, you know, dealing with the conversations that are coursing through the culture. Maybe a lot of people would be like, why did you show this? All I know is I heard everybody laughing in their cars. Casey loved it, which unless Casey like shared with you something different, Daniel, but Casey was saying he thought it was hilarious and he doesn't like John Hughes movies. We were all sitting laughing, and I thought the miracle of the movie is when you pitch it, you're like, that movie's going to be like everyone was saying. That movie sounds like it's going to be real toxic and this and that. And the weird thing it turns out is that Kelly LeBrock is empowered the entire time. She is the one that takes on the parents. She is the one that tells the boys they got to be adults. They got to do things. And what she's really doing is, as Connor said, helping them be better men. They don't hook up with her. She's just like dealing with Chet. And like Bill Paxton is hilarious. So I weirdly would just say, I think John Hughes hit some weird thing where Weird Science and Ferris Bueller's I find to be his two funniest movies. So he hit this weird funny peak. And then, I mean, I love Planes, Trains, it's a different thing. But
I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is his greatest movie. So take that.
Okay, there you go. I love Planes, Trains. Right after Weird Science, if you can believe it, I mean, when we talk about runs, really, if you want to get in directorial runs, Francis Ford Coppola had Godfather 1, The Conversation, Godfather 2, Apocalypse Now. That's a pretty crazy run. John Hughes had 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, all written and directed within about 3 years. That's kind of a crazy run, although some people may not be hot on Weird. But anyway, he ends this run with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 1986, literally 8 months after Weird Science.
It's the quintessential slacker who comes up with this plan to skip school and get his friends out of school, and then they have a great day in Chicago.
Ferris Bueller is often considered one of the high points. Very few people disagree. Many people say, whether it's their favorite or not, that Ferris is one of the high points of John Hughes' body of work.
I think it's my favorite John Hughes. It's the one, I think, kind of like Weird Science. It's sort of this unique, it stands on its own. It does, it's all the highs of what John Hughes came to be known for, sort of contained in a single thing. I think my favorite detail about it is that Ferris Bueller is really not the main character, because he has no arc. He is Ferris from start to end.
Yeah, I was going
to
bring that up.
And that, I think, presents something really cool, because it puts it on Cameron, who gets to make a change. He sort of sees himself, but then also what Ferris can do. So what Ferris is capable of with, like, this, you know, his passion and sort of the way he goes about things, for good and bad. He sort of sees this, what he's missing to some degree.
I'm not the first person to point this out, but there's a reading of this film that is similar to Fight Club, where with Ferris as Tyler Durden and Cameron as the narrator. I think it kind of works. Obviously, Ferris is the more benevolent version of that character.
The movie works because of Matthew Broderick's performance. Like, I think that's a hard role, because he's this, I mean, he should be, it's almost like a Chevy, it kind of is like a Chevy Chase character, where he should be bordering on unlikable. The way he behaves and what he does to his parents and the school, and even the way he treats his friends to some degree, even if it's for, you know, making in the name of fun for him and getting them to experience the fun with him. Like, he's like ruining this principal. I mean, the principal's an a-hole, but he's like ruining that man's life.
And a
going
pedophile.
Against. Yeah. Is he really?
In real life.
In real life. Oh. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Okay. I was like, did I miss a subplot? Ferris has to exude that, the type of kid, like the cool kid dynamic that I think every 80s and 90s teen movie tries to get and then fails at, because this sort of nailed it.
No one's caught Ferris.
So I read a review that described him as, you know, there's the manic pixie dream girl dynamic that's been coined. And
yeah,
but Ferris is the manic pixie dream boy. He is this idealized, you know,
he's the genie from Aladdin.
Yeah, he's like this whimsical singing and dancing, like, he's a teen, but he's so knowledgeable, and he's got all these things to, like, make sure that he doesn't get caught.
It's genuinely profound. I actually got pretty emotional during the painting scene. I know that's, like, that made me, like, kind of tear up a little bit. I don't know. There's something about that.
That's a beautiful scene. So the funny thing about Ferris that some people don't know is that, and actually this was fairly, you know, John Hughes is probably what you would say a writer first. Even John Hughes says this, he's a writer first and a director second. Interestingly, the original cut of Ferris had a younger brother and sister Bueller. There are actually four siblings in the Bueller family, and there was a lot of comedy with them, the younger siblings. And then the order of the movie was all rearranged. The museum and the parade happened at the beginning of the day, and then everything something else happened later. And when they did the first screening, and Matthew Broderick and Mia Sara and Alan Ruck were there, you know, Cameron, Simone, and Ferris.
So they shot this stuff with the other two kids?
Yeah, they shot it all. And they watched it, and they thought they were in the first bad John Hughes movie. And they were like, oh, no. And they left that. And John Hughes and famous editor Paul Hirsch, who edited Star Wars, among many other movies, they sat down and they said, OK. And they actually had this blessing in disguise because it takes place all in one day. Ferris, Simone and Cameron and everybody are wearing the same clothes the whole day. So you just don't know when something's happening. So they cut out all the brother and sister stuff. They put the parade in the museum towards the end when it had been earned. They trimmed everything and suddenly the movie sung. And so I always like to talk about, like, I love every step of movie making. I love writing a movie. I love directing a movie. I'm one of those people. I love production. I'm not somebody who hates production. I love it, even though it's the most stressful time and I always lose like 20 pounds. But I love production because I love working with actors. And then I love editing. But editing is writing. And I was telling Casey that if you're a writer, you've got to look at editing as another rewrite of the script. I always like to overshoot stuff, as Connor has learned, unfortunately, with the radio hour. I like to overdo stuff because I always know I can cut it and rearrange it. So I overdo it, and then I just cut and rearrange. And I love discovering things and just maybe even sometimes doing a revision of the story. And that happened here. And so the museum sequence you're talking about, Connor, originally was like the first thing they did. It didn't work, so they put it towards the end of the day. Why do you love that scene?
Cameron is a character who I think kind of similar to the Anthony Michael Hall character. This idea of someone who's nervous to do things like is very speaks to me. He's identifying with this small person in this painting, this nondescript person. And there's something sad about there. I just genuinely sad about that. And like that realization that you are, you know, you're not one of these people in the front. You're huh. This person, this out of focus little blob of color in the background. And you're just sort of stuck. You're just there. Alan Ruck is also great in the movie, we should say.
I was going to say, I found this great kind of middle of the road review on Letterboxd from a user named Screening Notes that I think is really funny and maybe true. He gave it a 3 out of 5 and he said, in a selfish attempt to cope with his separation anxiety, a sociopathic high school student abuses his relationship with his mentally unstable best friend in order to throw his future away on a single day of debauchery. And thinking it in that context does sort of, you're like, okay, yeah, maybe that's the real plot of this film.
That's a very materialist way to look at the film, I would say. Yeah. And it's interesting that this came out in the 80s. It feels very, even though it is a Reagan era thing, it feels very anti that era.
And the top comment on that review is, you're such a Cameron. Which I think is perfect.
I consider this to be one of the best teen movies of all time. It's just, you know, I relate to Ferris because I myself did that as a teen. You know, did school, just stay home, do nothing.
Well, you did do it, Cameron.
No, I did the whole Ferris thing. Just fake being sick and stay home. I just didn't want to go to school. I don't know why. You know, I was a monster back then. You know, I was a demon. The whole principal thing, trying to track down Ferris and take him down, that's very hilarious. And you know, the best part in that whole movie is that parade scene. That whole parade scene is so well done. It's probably one of the best things in the movie. Like, he just sells it. He just gave it all. Like, the whole segment where everyone's dancing, having a great time with the Beatles.
It is a pretty stunning, when you think about how they had to do that. I was reading about it. It's stunning how they pulled it off. There was an actual parade, no surprise. And all the wide shots were caught the day of the actual parade. So when you get that amazing wide shot where he's on the float and there appear to be 5,000 people behind him, that really was the day of the parade. And they even went by the stand with the judges. The judges were like, what's going on? And then they shot all the close-up stuff across like the other days, which is, of course, the way you would do it. But that's a pretty hard sequence to pull off.
I think we should also give credit to Jennifer Grey as Jeannie. One of my favorite moments in the movie is after she gets kissed in the police station
by Charlie Sheen.
There's just like this moment of catharsis she has when she's leaving that I adore.
And then the music is like an original cue where they're singing Jeannie, and they're like, Jeannie, Jeannie. And then she like, he asks what her real name is, and she says it, and then they say her real name. So I think the thing that I was trying to say about Weird Science is I think the zaniness of Weird Science somehow freed John Hughes to make Ferris. Because when you think about the jokes in Ferris, some of them are ridiculous. Like, I love the joke where already it's the same day, but in the newspaper, there's that article that, like, community rallies around sick youth. And then there's, like, you know, the cops are like, hey, tell your son we're all pulling for him. And then, like, during the parade, just random pedestrians organize a dance number, which is, like, now a trope that gets used in everything. But there are these, this is just funny jokes that go along with a plot line that really could happen. You know, like when the valets steal the car. I love that bit too. And there's just the Star Wars music, you know, and you get that shot. It's almost like John Hughes having as much fun as Ferris. But as you said, Connor, so Ferris Bueller's is my favorite John Hughes, hands down. I was telling Casey this weekend, I think you guys were hitting it about wish fulfillment. Two of the characters that I relate to the most, not because I'm like them, but maybe because I aspire to them in a weird way, are Ferris Bueller. And then actually Leonardo DiCaprio in Catch Me If You Can, Frank Abagnale Jr. And the reason for that is I think those two characters, they think with a fox mind. They both have fox minds, and they understand that in this world, you have to be a bit of a fox to get through it. And I love how Ferris figures that out. And I love how now Frank, of course, gets he's a con man and he eventually has to change his ways. But they're free thinking enough. But they've got good hearts that they somehow, I hate that, they just somehow figure out how to walk between the raindrops a little bit and have a good existence. And I think there's a message in both those movies about you need to understand that society is structured sometimes in a way where you're not going to have a fun time, or that's going to make you feel bad, or you're going to feel like I have to do it this way. But those fox minds that go, well, why? Why do I, you know, why is sitting in this classroom, you know, like you were saying, Connor, they go to the museum, which probably is infinitely more educational than sitting with some of those bad teachers. Or, you know, Cameron has this catharsis with the car, which is probably infinitely more helpful to him as a human being than whatever would have happened, you know, and Ferris even says it. So I was trying to think what kind of character Ferris would be. And I think the genie or the wish fulfillment, because in a weird way, like Ferris does that almost to teach Cameron a lesson. There's this weird thing of like he's trying to get Cameron to grow, which is a little presumptive and kind of like, who are you to do that with Cameron? Anyway, I love the film. I can't say enough about it. I watch it twice a year. It's just one of my favorite films of all time.
But I always think it'd be interesting to do a double feature of Ferris Bueller with Election, which is obviously a very different film in a lot of ways. Yeah, it's like the bad version. I've heard people read that film as like what would happen to Ferris Bueller when he grows up.
Yeah, and didn't figure it out.
And didn't figure it out and tried to didn't actually evolve. I think at some point we got to do for a Christmas movie. I think maybe you're a little past the age to really love it, but I think Daniel, you're probably in the same boat with Home Alone, mm-hmm. which I think is a legit. I think that first one especially is like a legitimately really great movie. A modern movie, because I know you were thinking about watching some of these, Craig, is that the most recent Spider-Man movies are actually really heavily influenced by John Hughes. Mm. They're very heavily focused on all the characters being in high school and their relationships with each other. And there's like teacher characters and things like that.
Was the second one good?
Both of them were good. The first one is like in New York. And then the second one is like literally like it's like a European vacation. It's like the class goes on a class trip. But then Spider-Man stuff happens.
And for whatever it's worth, and we'll keep going, I actually really like Home Alone 1, and I enjoy Home Alone 2. Yeah, I'm not down on him. I think all I was saying was...
I didn't know. I know some people who are, like, a little older aren't as, like, into them. Yeah, I like the second one, too, but it's just kind of like the first one, but... again.
Yeah, I recognize Home Alone 1 and Home Alone 2 as legitimately good movies and good scripts. Yeah, I think what I was trying to get at is I mourn that from that point on, he just produced children's movies and wasn't interested in original material that he directed. Other John Hughes closing thoughts.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which is one of the greatest John Hughes movies of all time. Actually, no, it's one of his best films ever because I relate to John Candy in so many ways as possible. It's insane. I always do this bit with my friend Evan, who can be a dick sometimes, and whenever I bring up the quote in the motel scene where John Candy's letting Steve Martin have it, like, you want to hurt me? Go right ahead, make you feel any better. I'm an easy target. I always do that to annoy him because he knows he's the Steve Martin character because that's who he is. Because he's somewhat of a kind of a dick in some parts of the movie because that's him all the way. But John Candy, to me, my God, that performance is amazing. I watch it every single Thanksgiving. That's like the perfect holiday movie of all time.
You should know that's great. First of all, I want to commend you on what's like a brilliant jujitsu move. If anyone ever quoted that to me, I would shut up no matter what I was saying.
Exactly.
Unless they were so nakedly emotionally manipulative, I'd be like, you're just being emotionally manipulative again. I just wanted to say, we didn't have time in this, but of the John Hughes movies after his teen phase, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is one of my favorites. You know, I would probably say my three favorite Hughes are Weird Science, Ferris, and Planes, Trains. I think Planes, you know, we showed Planes, Trains. So, and it's great because it's about two adults.
I think Hughes is interesting because he hits you at all stages of life. He has credits on dad movies. He has credit on like kids movies, and he has credit on teen movies. And I think that's really unique from a filmmaker because you can sort of take something from all walks of life as you get older. I'm definitely on the Home Alone front. I love me some Home Alone. Great, great stuff. Hughes is also responsible for something I loved so much as a kid, and I am so afraid to rewatch, which is the Robin Williams Flubber.
Oh, God.
He wrote and produced that, and I loved it when I was, I think I came out when I was like 7, and I am scared of it now.
I heard that and Miracle on 34th Street were actually two of the later good ones.
Some of the stuff I've read about Flubber make me scared. I mean, there's a part in Flubber that I remember from being 7 where Flubber comes out of someone's butt. So,
oh, God. What the
I mean, they're still doing that. That was the climax of that Doolittle film that came out this year, was Robert Downey Jr. pulling bagpipes out of a dragon's ass. That movie's probably going to win an Oscar because it's going to be one of the 5 movies that came out.
I would say that Hughes is one of those people like Billy Wilder to me that I am a bit obsessed with because, like I said, I think they're writers first. You might call Woody Allen. I know Woody Allen is not someone people like to talk about these days, but Woody Allen would probably also be a writer first. John Hughes, Billy Wilder, Cameron Crowe. There are probably others we could name right away who probably were writers first and then became directors to protect their scripts. But I study Hughes a lot. I'm jealous of how productive he was. I'm amazed at how his stuff works, even though he's making things in ostensibly the real world. As we talked about with Ferris and Weird Science, there's some totally out of left field stuff in Hughes movies that he pulls off. I love that it comes down to the human. But I also love that he gets what makes a movie a movie. You know, I would say more than a lot of writers who become directors, a Hughes film feels like a movie to me. He gets a visual joke. You know, he said that he wasn't really into lenses and stuff, but they're still shot really well. So at least he had the good sense to hire a great cinematographer. And they're actually all visually consistent. And he worked with different visual cinematographers, so he knew where to put the camera. He knew how to edit or at least trust a good editor. He was obviously a genius at what he did. And even though I don't know that what I would do, you know, it's not like he's somebody I want to be the next John Hughes. He's still someone that I study. And I think he's someone that people who love movies could and should study. And I think you can get a lot of inspiration from him. So it was a joy talking to you guys about it. So let's move on to pop culture final thoughts. We'll do a bit of a lightning round and wrap up. Who wants to go first?
I rewatched all of the Ocean movies, starting with 13, then 12, then 11 backwards. I think Ocean 13 is the best one out of all of them. And actually, this gave me an idea for another video, a heist video, kind of similar to the Ocean movies. But I pitched to my friend, and we took a different turn. It's now going to be a emo or goth video now. So that's going to be fun.
Did you watch Ocean's 8?
I'm staying away from that one. That one
sucked.
Well,
then you didn't watch all of them.
Yeah. 8's actually pretty great.
Screw Ocean's 8. No.
Hey, you just made Connor leave with your sexism.
No, if they brought back Steven Soderbergh it would have been a much better movie. But no.
Have you seen, but Edwin, how you haven't seen it yet? I haven't seen it by the way.
I have seen it. Oh, okay. I have seen it. I just didn't like it.
I love the Ocean's movies, but I think Steven Soderbergh's best heist movie is Logan Lucky.
I got to see that one.
Okay, I agree with you on that one.
But it's a blessing to have them all.
If they brought back Steven Soderbergh to make Ocean's 8, I think it would have been a much better movie.
It was a joke. We can move on.
You're a joke!
I'm still powering through some TV shows. Perry Mason ended last night. Incredible first season. I know nothing about Perry Mason, so I have no idea how it follows into the rest of the show, but a beautiful 1930s detective, very graphic and jarring thriller on HBO. And then I also started Russian Doll, which I missed a few years ago, and I'm almost done with that. And I'm disappointed in myself because that's also pretty phenomenal. It takes the Groundhog's Day dynamic and puts a spin on it. Oh, the only other thing I was going to see is there's been some news coming out that Disney, who now owns Fox, is going to cease a lot of their physical media production, including any new 4K restoration of their older live-action stuff. So if there are movies that you love that are not Disney's biggest properties like Marvel and Star Wars, maybe buy them, because we could be in a future soon where we have no control over what we have access to. And it might be good to have those to hold close.
I didn't do anything this week. I played Oblivion some for about 5 minutes at a time, usually because it would crash. Thanks, Todd Howard, for that. I love your deeply unstable games. But you can watch me stream games, sometimes those, on twitch.tv/Connor.
I will say to our audience, I don't know if you're interested in this or not, we are actually, even though we've gone to parking lot cinema, we're going to keep it under wraps, trying to innovate, and I will talk to the team, a way of doing our virtual cinema for the future and bringing it back that actually will allow us to show anything. And you won't have to have a subscription, and it'll be native to Secret Movie Club. But that will be in development for a while. But please know, if you're not in Southern California, or you're just like, hey, I want to stay inside for a while because of COVID, we are going to try to at least, I don't know when, but we're looking to develop that. Lastly, that's it. Just this weekend, guys, Friday and Saturday at the Sears Glendale parking lot. We would love to have you if you're here in the Los Angeles area. On Friday night, we are going to show The Big Lebowski at 8:15 and then Punch Drunk Love at 11. You can get a double feature ticket, stay the whole night, or you can get an A feature or B feature. If you are going to come to the B feature, just try to come after 10 o'clock. That'll just make everything smooth in the transition. And then Saturday night, we're doing a high school double album double feature. We're going to do Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused at 8:15, and then Amy Heckerling's Fast Times at Ridgemont High at 10:30. And you can get tickets on Eventbrite, Secret Movie Club, or at any of our social media channels. And that's it. We're heading into the middle of August. I think the last thing I'll say is just remember, and by the way, this is going to be hypocritical, and it is hypocritical because I'm not doing anything other than trying to survive like a lot of you guys and thinking about my business. But we have an election coming up in 95 days.
Oh boy.
And nobody should take it for granted. If you've spent the last 4 years, as I have, being pretty disappointed in what should have been a functioning branch of government, the only way to rectify that is to get out and vote. So wherever you are, you know, we should all do a few hours of volunteer work, find out where your poll is, find out how mail-in voting works, tell other people about it. I would just tell people, I did this last election, pick 5 people that you know in other parts of the country who value what you have to say and will listen to you. Obviously, don't go lecturing people because no one likes that. But if you got 5 people that you know in critical key states, help them find their polling place, help them find their mail-in voting, because we have an election in 90 days.
And at the very least, if you haven't voted before, vote.
Please vote. Yeah. Let's not let our apathy and sort of disillusionment, don't let that deter you from voting. The single biggest thing each of us can do individually, for real, no idealism here, is vote. And however you want to vote, I'm not telling you how to vote. I wouldn't do that. But I am asking you to vote. So please vote. That's it. So guys, it's a pleasure as always. We always find these podcasts as we go. It's a little bit of jazz. And thank you guys for staying in on John Hughes on this one. And let's get ready for the second weekend. I wish all of you the best, both the Secret Movie Club team and everyone out there. Thank you for putting up with us. Watch great movies. We love you, and we'll see you in a week. All right, guys, take care.
Bye.
Edwin was a champ, man. Tell Connor some stories about this weekend.
Connor, man, everything went to shit, man. First night was bad. A lot of people got pissed off at us. We rioted. There was a lot of kung fu action going on. made it.
Where was I for that?
You ran away because, like, oh God, no, I didn't do it right, no. Like,
wow, what an awful boss, and I left you guys to deal with it.
Yeah, but don't worry, man. We took care of the bad guys, man. We took care of the bad guys. We just go, bah, bah, bah.